8:30?
No, we're here till 9:30.
I started in this morning.
Yeah. Is that okay?
Swim.
All right. Well, this is being recorded now. So let's go ahead and begin. We are on page 311. We have just talked about the third line of evidence for the beginning of the universe, and that is the second law of thermodynamics, or really just the laws of thermodynamics. And having talked about that, I say, is there any way to avoid our conclusion at this point? And I say there's been several attempts to avoid the absolute beginning of the universe, and unfortunately, these hypotheses have little or no positive evidence in their favor, and they inevitably contradict the facts. And so here are going to be three hypotheses that we look at sort of in the middle of our presentation. Attempts to avoid the absolute beginning. So, first is Stephen Hawking's no boundary proposal. Stephen Hawking has suggested that the universe may very well be finite, but nevertheless has no boundaries. If this is so, then we may be able to avoid the idea of a beginning altogether, and hence there will be no need to postulate a creator of the space-time continuum. And this is what he writes. When we combine quantum mechanics with general relativity, there seems to be a new possibility that did not arise before, that space and time together might form a finite, four-dimensional space without singularities or boundaries, like the surface of the Earth, but with more dimensions. It seems that this idea could explain many of the observed features of the universe, such as its large-scale uniformity, and also the smaller-scale departures from homogeneity, like galaxies and stars and even human beings. It could even account for the arrow of time we observe. But the universe is completely self-contained, with no singularities or boundaries, and completely described by a unified theory, that has profound implications for the role of God as creator. Quentin Smith has summarized this argument as follows. Here it is. If Euclidean space-time is physically existent, I'll explain these terms, by the way, but if Euclidean space-time is physically existent and Lorentzian space-time a theoretical fiction, then there is no real time at which the universe began. If there is no real time at which the universe began to exist, then there is no real beginning that God created. Euclidean space-time physically exists and Lorentzian space-time does not. Therefore, there is no real beginning created by God. Therefore, God does not exist. Now, if you go to the footnote, I say this. It's hard to tell at this point in his career whether Hawking is a deist or an atheist. The following statement implies that he was at least a deist at one point in his life. He says, "With the success of scientific theories in describing events, most people have come to believe that God allows for the universe to evolve according to a set of laws and does not interfere in the universe to break these laws. However, the laws do not tell us what the universe should have looked like when it started. It would still be up to God to wind up the clockwork and choose how to start it off." The following statement suggests that Hawking is an atheist. If there is no boundary to space-time, there would be no singularity at which one would have to appeal to God or some new law to set the boundary conditions for space-time. One could say, the boundary condition of the universe is that it has no boundary. The universe would be completely self-contained and not affected by anything outside of itself. It would be neither created nor destroyed. It would just be. Okay. So what is Euclidean space-time? On the next page, Euclidean space-time is really just another word for imaginary time. What is imaginary time? Imaginary time is the time that transcends the real time that you and I experience. Now, if such a notion of time actually corresponds to reality, then we could picture the universe that possesses a spherical time dimension. So it may be that we're just on a large sphere, and from our perception, we're traveling down a linear path, but at the end of the day, we're actually part of a larger network, a larger sphere that's totally self-contained. So picture that in your head, like a train track. And there's a large sphere so big that we could go for millions upon billions upon billions upon billions of years down this arrow of time and never notice that we've gotten off the track. Okay? Now, we would then have a time dimension, if this whole proposal is true, that possesses a spherical dimension, a time dimension that is spherical, that is finite, but without a boundary, much like our Earth is finite, yet because it is a circle, has no boundary. We would, of course, make all of our observations in real time in which events occur on a linear plane. Our perception of the universe would be one that started from nothing and progressively grew in size, kind of like the train. Our perception is the train tracks start somewhere and they progress in time. But in actuality, time has always existed. Thus, imaginary time would be the real time, and really the real time would be imaginary. So the train track scenario would just be nothing more than our perception of what's really going on. If this is so, this would indicate that time is beginningless, and hence there is nothing for God to create in the beginning. As Hawking says, so long as the universe had a beginning, we could suppose that it had a creator. But if the universe is really completely self-contained, having no boundary or edge, it would have neither beginning nor end. It would simply be. What place, then, for a creator? Now, remember Einstein's quotation, "The man of science is a poor philosopher." Even if all of that is true, it would do nothing to vindicate atheism. Nothing. Why? We spend an entire block of time, pardon the pun, talking about the Thomistic argument, showing that even if the universe was beginningless, we would still have a God who causes it. Thomas would speak of God as eternally creating the universe. That's what his proof proves. But I would just rather speak of God sustaining the universe. But either way you look at it, there is a place for a kind of cause of the universe that is much like the classical theistic God, even on this proposal. So what do you mean, what place then for a creator? Does that make sense? So just to repeat myself, we took a little break there, but just to repeat myself, he doesn't fully appreciate what Thomas Aquinas has done. So again, I'm just being repetitive here, but remember that the man of science is a poor philosopher, and this is an illustration of that fact. Any questions about this before we take the next step? Yeah.
Questions. I mean, so you know, we're saying that, you know, according to the Thomistic argument, you know, even an infinite series of events in a closed system would itself, that system, be contingent and thus require...
Yes.
And it would still require...
What he would have to show is the necessary nature of the universe. Now, I will say this. When he speaks of the universe as self-contained, right, he's really just trying to give the universe the same properties as God. So in one sense, Hawking is really shooting for pantheism.
Right. For the universe is, was, and always shall be, and it's a
lot... It must be, yeah. It's logically necessary.
He's embracing something from nothing, it seems.
Well, he's saying that it's just always been here. In reality, it's always been here. So this is just an attempt to avoid the creation. Look at footnote 85. Here's what he says, what a scientific theory is. He says, a scientific theory is just a mathematical model we make to describe our observations. It exists only in our minds. So it is meaningless to ask which is real, real or imaginary time. It is simply a matter of which is the more useful description. So he's a non-realist scientist. He doesn't believe that our scientific theories necessarily match reality. Okay? This is a hard thing to grasp, but he sees the implications of this because in one of his latest books, The Grand Design, which I don't review here, the next edition of this, where I go back through and revise it, we'll have a full review of his book that he wrote with a co-author, Mladenov. And but in the foreword to the book, or the preface or introduction to the book, he says that he continues to embrace a kind of non-realist understanding of science. This is his philosophy of science. And he doesn't think that we should try to make sure our theories match reality. We should just seek for the most coherent theory. And if coherence is the standard, this takes us all the way back in the prior series on Weltanschauung, where we define truth as correspondence to reality. If truth is really judged in terms of just coherence, he admits, and he explicitly says this, young earth creationism becomes just as plausible as naturalistic evolution. Just put that in your pipe. Put that in your pipe and smoke for a minute. If your scientific theory is nothing more than a mathematical model, a hypothesis that is clear, sheerly tested in terms of its coherence, then that means that young earth creationism is just as plausible as naturalistic evolution. Now, this is an interesting point because Ken Ham's philosophy of science is almost exactly like Stephen Hawking's. So they have the same philosophy of science. They just don't have the same science.
They have different presuppositions.
Because their presuppositions are different. But the presuppositionalism of a Ken Ham is to be likened to the non-realism of a Stephen Hawking. Which raises another question altogether, and it takes me back to my critique of Van Til. Does presuppositionalism really give you the truth? Does it get you to truth? Or does it merely get you to coherence? Yes.
You say that, so Hawking, in terms of just looking at merely coherent, rather than reality-adhering arguments, it's kind of like the distinction between a logically valid argument versus a logically sound argument.
Absolutely. So it doesn't, it's almost like, and I don't want to put too many words in his mouth, it's almost like Hawking isn't concerned with soundness. He's really just concerned with validity.
But at that point, then how can you say that any viewpoint is actually superior to another if you've taken soundness out of
it? He takes, in the footnote here, he takes a pragmatic approach. What is the more useful description? It's pragmatism. We're back to scroll. It's just more useful to me to look at the universe this way.
But pragmatism would be entirely subjective, wouldn't it?
You know, yeah, we're back to a kind of subjectivism where, I have my model, you have your model. As long as I can't poke holes in your model and show that your model is incoherent, I guess you have a right to it.
So it's relativist.
Yeah, it's a kind of relativism. I mean, scientific non-realism is philosophically speaking, just a kind of form of perspectivalism, where your perspective is no more, better, or worse than anybody else's. So we just have competing models, and what we're about now is just poking holes in your model in terms of the coherence of it. But I can't offer a fact which is just undeniable that you must accept, factually speaking, and thereby reconciling your scientific theory with the truth. Now, what would I use to demonstrate to Hawking that realism is true and this non-realism is false? I would look at the work of Hawking himself and just take the phenomenal career of this man that just passed away a few months ago. His space-time theorems predicted that we would learn that space and time really did have a beginning. He even predicted through theoretical physics the existence of black holes. Well, when did we empirically justify the existence of black holes? In the 90s. The Hubble telescope actually gave empirical evidence that they existed. So what theoretical physicists have done for us is years ago they've made predictions about what we would discover, and we've discovered them. To me, that is a very strong argument in favor of realism. You have a theory, and it's partly judged on whether it can predict future discoveries. And what are we discovering? We're discovering facts. I mean, the model is not judged on its mere coherence. It's just, I mean, I agree with Hawking precisely because we did discover black holes in the 90s, almost 30 years after he set forth his theory. So I am, you can't help but be impressed by his work. And I'll say, you just want to say, don't you see that what you're doing, your work, is a testimony to the realist notion of what science is? In any case, Quentin Smith, one of my favorite atheistic writers, says this in response to Hawking's argument. He says, this is probably the worst atheistic argument in the history of Western thought. That's a quotation. Now, recently, this essay was written in the 90s, and recently William Lane Craig wrote a critique of Richard Dawkins' argument against God's existence, and Craig said, we need to take the crown or dethrone Hawking's argument and place Dawkins' argument against God's existence on the throne, because Dawkins is even worse than this. And we'll get to Dawkins when we get to the design argument, but that's the opinion of William Lane Craig. But the very fact that you have a top-notch, top-flight atheistic scholar saying this is one of the worst arguments that you can find against God's existence, you may want to, your antennas may want to go up and hear what he has to say. While Smith is probably making an overstatement, I say, we agree that Hawking's argument falls far short of the refutation of our premise, let alone the existence of God. Indeed, Hawking himself admits the suggestion is just a proposal, he says. It cannot be deduced from any other principle.
You think he was coming from the same mindset he was when he predicted black holes?
No, I think that, I don't know if y'all have seen the movie Theory of Everything, which is the life of... It's a great movie, and in the movie, there's a conversation. His wife, his first wife, was a committed Christian, and that whole story is fascinating. But in the movie, there's a scene where Hawking, his wife, and the choir director of the church, the wife will later have an affair with the choir director. But the choir director of the church is, they're having a conversation. And the choir director looks at him and says, well, your work has proved God's existence because you proved that the universe had a beginning. And therefore, that has to have a beginner. And Hawking says, well, having now demonstrated God's existence, I'm set to disprove God's existence. So he was clearly in the mindset of, I got to do something to get around the implications of what my theory has actually proven.
I just wondered if he got closer to the end of it.
There's no indication that he was ever willing to concede the existence of a creator. We have absolutely no evidence.
He really wasn't in the pure science of it. He had a motive.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He's a good example of how there is no neutrality in this world. Yeah.
Good question. So, according to that quote, if it is just a proposal and it cannot be deduced
from any other person,
then doesn't that mean that he's relying purely on inductive reasoning at that point?
Oh, I think what he means here is that I'm giving a coherent theory, or hypothesis, really. It's not even a theory. I'm giving a coherent hypothesis. There's no fact that science has discovered from which I'm deducing my hypothesis. It's just a proposal.
It's an admission that it's an unscientific...
Right. There's no scientific reason to believe this other than, do you want to avoid the implications of Big Bang cosmology? Now, beyond the lack of empirical support for the proposal, we should remember that Hawking's ideas are based on Richard Feynman's sum over history's theory. Now, I have to explain that, right? What is Feynman's sum over history's theory? And now, if you go to the footnote, I say that, and I'm quoting, Hawking here. There are special numbers called imaginary that give negative numbers when multiplied by themselves. The one called I, when multiplied by itself, gives negative 1. 2i multiplied by itself gives negative 4, and so on. To avoid the technical difficulties with Feynman's sum over histories, one must use imaginary time. That is to say, for the purposes of calculation, one must measure time using imaginary numbers rather than real ones. This is an interesting effect on space-time. The distinction between time and space disappears completely. And that's why you start thinking of time in terms of a sphere. It becomes a good metaphor for all this because time and space just have no distinction. So you're in the sphere, right, of time. Well, that's a spatial image, right, but it's a temporal idea. And I point out that, however, this is my response to this, this conflation of space and time yields a contradiction, for temporal relations are, by definition, earlier than and later than relationships, making it impossible to conflate time into space, which yields a different kind of relation. What is a spatial relation? Well, spatial relations, you can describe them in different ways. You can describe spatial relations as before and after, like if I'm standing in a line, I'm before and after you. But you can't describe spatial relations in terms of earlier than, later than. So I'm standing in front of all of you, but I'm not earlier than you at the present moment, right? I'm not later than you at the present moment. So you can't conflate space and time that way. Again, the man of science is a poor philosopher.
It sounds like he was taking the same kind of liberty Einstein did.
Oh, sure. When he threw in his cosmological constant, this is just an attempt to try to get around the implications of the Big Bang. Now, most mathematicians would say that, as in the case with actual infinities, while the theory is helpful as a mathematical model, it does not describe reality as it actually is. But if the no-boundary approach is going to follow through, it seems imperative that Hawking utilize Feynman's sum over history as an attempt to describe what really happens independently of our minds. In short, Hawking must do more than give us the most useful description. If his proposal is to be interpreted along non-realist lines, then it becomes little more than a useful fiction, and at best is to be accepted only until something better comes along. But even here, it seems that there are many descriptions that are far more preferable to the no-boundary proposal. For example, accepting real time as real and reasoning from my empirical evidence that we live in a temporally finite universe. That's a better proposal than the sum over history's proposal, right? I'm at least appealing to a fact that is in tune with our common sense intuitions. Time is linear, and I'm reasoning that the universe has a beginning. Indeed, Hawking's proposal, as he stated, entails a universe that would simply be. Such a description of the universe would be an endorsement of a tenseless character of existence, and this would imply that Hawking rejects the A theory of time and adopts the B theory. However, we have already given good reason to reject the B theory in favor of the A theory. Hence, the A theory alone renders Hawking's proposal questionable at best. If, as it certainly seems, Hawking is proposing the no-boundary idea as a description of reality, what justification does he have for accepting the no-boundary proposal as opposed to, say, the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics, which, in effect, denies realism altogether with regard to the quantum world? Or why not try the alternative version of the Copenhagen interpretation, which states that quantum reality is non-existent until it is measured? Unless Hawking can give a justification of a realistic interpretation of his proposal, a realistic interpretation of Feynman's sum over history's approach on Hawking's part would be gratuitous. In other words, you can't just allow him to do that. He can't just assert that it's true. He has to give some justification for it. In short, Hawking has yet to give us a reason why his preference to accept imaginary time as real and real time as imaginary is simply that, a preference without a justification. As Craig states, the postulate of metaphysical superspace, the metamorphosis of real to imaginary time, the conflation of time and space, all these seem extravagant lengths to go to in order to avoid classical theism's doctrine of creatio ex nihilo, which forces us in Hawking to confront a squarely different question, or to confront squarely a different question, what price then for no creator? Remember he said, what place then for a creator? What price are you willing to pay? And this should be something I need to stop for a minute and just suggest to both of you. When you're talking to people about God's existence, half the time it really is, it boils down to this, what are you willing to give up to hold on to your position? That's what the debate becomes. Okay, so we have this evidence for a Big Bang. What are you willing to give up in order to secure your belief that the universe has always existed? You got to go in this direction. a non-realist interpretation of science, saying that imaginary time is real. This was one alternative. Well, at some point you have to ask, that's just too much to give up. Why am I supposed to give up my basic intuitions about the way the world works just to avoid the implications? Why don't I just go with the implications? Because that's where the evidence is pointing to anyway, right?
Well, I actually thought about this after saying it. Right. When we were talking about younger versus older.
Sure.
And where, you know, different people of faith fall down.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Six-day creation.
Sure.
And my thought after we had that discussion Saturday was, if we're arguing for Jesus as the Son of God,
right,
and the only salvation, then what difference would it make? It would not
sure.
change his deity.
Either way, yeah.
Either
hold on to that. I'm willing to shed a whole lot. And here's another thing. So the point, for those that may have missed that on the recording, the point is that Christians have a basic belief in Christ. And so you give me evidence for an old earth, I'd rather embrace that. I'd rather shed what might be an implied statement in the Bible to hold on to the deity of Christ with, you know, rationally speaking. I'd rather do that than give up Christ for anything. And here's another way to look at it. We just listened to Hawking give this proposal that he says is just a proposal. It's just an idea, you know. It's coherent. I hear young earth creationists talk like this all the time. For example, there is a belief called the canopy theory. Have you all heard of the canopy theory?
With the veil of water that would have been over the earth, and radiation,
sure,
a longer,
yes,
flood,
right, yeah. So you have, yeah, so the canopy is, some people even interpret it as a kind of ice pack, some people interpret it as just water, but it's water almost in outer space, okay, and it's just surrounding the earth's atmosphere. And before Noah's flood, there it was, this canopy, and that explains, because it blocked radiation coming through and all that. It allowed people to live much longer lives in the Bible. We had that sort of thing. And it explains where the water came from. It came from the upper atmosphere. Right, and so Kent Hovind, I saw him on national television debate Hugh Ross on this, and you can get this debate on YouTube. He says, well, it's just a theory. Okay? It's just an idea. Well, that itself doesn't appreciate the difference between a hypothesis and a theory and a law. An hypothesis is really just an idea. And so what Ken Hovind is offering is an hypothesis. He's not offering a theory. The theory has to have genuine evidence supporting it and has to make predictions about the way the world is going to work in the future. Plus, there are dissertations that are written now that shows that the canopy could not have existed. It just couldn't have. Gravity would have brought that water down long before. Now, if you want to say that God is tinkering with things so that the water was just holding up there miraculously, well, that means that God didn't allow natural law to kick into place until after the flood. So are we now going to say that the laws of physics and biology and so forth did not change until after the flood? Or that they did change with the flood? Are we going to say all that sort of thing? And what is your evidence for all of this? Well, that kind of idea is just as radical, the canopy theory, as this no boundary proposal. And this kind of glib response, it's just a hypothesis or it's just a theory, is just as strange sounding to me as this no boundary idea. Because they're both saying, forget the way the universe seems to appear to me. I'm going to go in this direction. So, at the end of the day, who's giving up on reality here? Is the atheist clinging to reality? If you're having to do this to save your atheism or naturalism, why don't you just come on over here? Because we're offering reality to you. And to the young earth creationists, I would say something similar. I know young earth creationists who believe that dinosaurs never existed. What do you do with all this fossil evidence? Well, God planted them there to test our faith, or Satan planted them there to deceive us. Again, what are you willing to give up to keep your faith? And what are you willing to, what luggage, what metaphysical baggage are you willing to load onto yourself to maintain a certain idea or theory or hypothesis or whatever you want to call it? I would say strip all that away and just try as much as you can to go with common sense. Let me say one more thing about that. Bertrand Russell famously pointed out in his book Problems of Philosophy that common sense is not so common. And common sense realism has led us to conclude that the universe is a lot stranger than what appears at first sight. I'm willing to grant all of that. But my proposal would be this. Hold on to your intuitions until they're disconfirmed. And the no boundary proposal is not a disconfirmation of our fundamental beliefs that time is an arrow and the earth is real and scientific theories match reality. That's not at all a refutation of that intuition. So when you have intuitions that are destroyed, like here's an intuition, it just seems intuitively obvious at first sight that the sun is going around the earth. Well, that's been disconfirmed. So that's the only time you should disconfirm your intuitions, is when facts run up against them. Then you need to adjust your intuitions to fit those. All right, so what is another option? Go ahead.
I heard a researcher say, I've never heard of it.
Yes, go ahead.
I was watching my Animal Planet.
Yeah, sure.
He says, you know, I don't proclaim anything. He says, I accept or I deny it.
Right.
And that was a pretty coherent statement.
Right. All I'm doing is accepting what the evidence seems to present itself as.
Right.
And why should I be faulted for that?
Yeah, you can. It doesn't disprove the flood to say that it didn't happen this way or did happen
sure.
this way, because every culture, almost every historical culture, has some record
of a flood.
Of
yeah,
flood.
Yeah.
And there's you know geologic evidence.
Sure.
So it doesn't necessarily explain the how. But you know,
sure.
for things where we have. That's why I go back to saying, you know, all of this, I love to do the research stuff like Noah's Ark. You know,
sure.
That's fascinating to me because, especially, you know, the anomaly up on Ararat.
Yeah, right.
I've always been
interested in those things, yeah.
And, you know, clearly something happened.
Something happened, yeah.
And, but if I come to the New Testament and I'm proclaiming Christ, then how it
the central claims of the Christian faith, yeah. Yeah.
And it holds up as well as any document in antiquity.
Sure.
Its coherency in the Bible and the New Testament. And the entire Bible, but especially, you know, in the New Testament.
Right.
So, and that's...
Yeah. So, yeah, I agree. But going back to natural theology.
Yeah, sorry.
No, that's fine. Eternal inflation is another proposal that's given to avoid the beginning. And Alexander Vilenkin describes this hypothesis. He says, an eternally inflating universe consists of an expanding sea of false vacuum, which is constantly spawning island universes like ours. Inflation will continue indefinitely in other remote regions, but if inflation is going to continue forever into the future, then perhaps it might have no beginning in the past. It might have had no beginning in the past. We would then have an eternally inflating universe without a beginning and without an end, and would eliminate the perplexing problems associated with the cosmic origin. Now, before I read the next sentence, and some of you already have, what does that sound like to you? You have all these little pocket universes out there, and they're just kind of expanding. What does that sound like? And they're just doing it from all eternity. And so from a vacuum fluctuation in quantum mechanics, new universes are just popping out and they're inflating all for all eternity. It sounds like the steady state model, doesn't it? And that's what Vilenkin says. He says the picture is reminiscent of the steady state model of the 40s and 50s. And that's all you have to say about it. You're going to have to show that all the problems with steady-state cosmology are, because what you're really saying is that there's this vacuum fluctuation going on somewhere in the universe that is just spawning baby universes. And so instead of matter being pushed out in a single universe, you just have universes being pushed out and expanding. But what's the difference? The difference is just matter is smaller than a universe. But it's still the same idea. It's just creation from virtually nothing or by pure random chance out there in the middle of nowhere. So what about the new oscillating model? In the early years of the 21st century, it seemed that the oscillating model was going to make a comeback. And this was mainly through the work of Paul Steinhardt and Neil Turok of Cambridge University. Vilenkin, again, is going to be the person that explains this to us. He says this, as in earlier oscillating models, they suggested that the history of the universe consists of an endlessly repeating cycle of expansion and contraction. Each cycle starts with a hot expanding fireball. It expands and cools down, galaxies form, and the vacuum energy comes to dominate the universe soon after. At this point, the universe starts expanding exponentially, with its size doubling every 10 billion years or so. After trillions of years of this superflow inflation, the universe becomes very homogeneous, isotropic, and flat. Eventually, the expansion slows down and then turns into contraction. The universe recollapses and immediately bounces back to start a new cycle. Part of the energy generated in the collapse goes to create another hot fireball of matter. Steinhardt and Turok argue that the problem of the beginning does not arise in their scenario. The universe has always been going through the same cycle, so there was no beginning. The problem of the heat death is also avoided because the amount of expansion in a cycle is greater than the amount of contraction, so the volume of the universe is increased after each cycle. The entropy of our observable region is now the same as the entropy of a similar region in the preceding cycle, but the entropy of the entire universe has increased simply because the volume of the universe is now greater. As time goes on, both the entropy and the total volume grow without bound. The state of maximum entropy is never reached because there is no maximum entropy. Now, unfortunately to these hypotheses, a new experiment by Vilenkin, Bord, and Guth have disconfirmed them both. And when I say both, I mean the new oscillating model and the eternal inflation model. So they did a new experiment, and this experiment refutes both of these models. To get a picture of their experiment, let us imagine that there's an observer in every galaxy within our corner of the universe. Because the cosmos is expanding, each observer is able to see the others moving away. Galaxies may not exist in some regions of space and time, but we can still imagine the entire universe sprinkled with observers in such a way that all of them are moving away from one another. To give these observers some name, we shall call them spectators. Okay, so y'all get the picture in your mind? You got perhaps an infinite number of observers, and they're just moving away from each other. Just picture that in your mind right now.
Sounds like the hotel all over.
Yeah. Now, let us imagine yet another observer moving relative to the spectators, a space traveler whom we will name Augustine. The name is mine, so I'm using their thought experiment, but Augustine is the name I give this guy. I can't make it Thomas, because Thomas is still in a cave trying to figure his way out of the cave, so we're going to have to appeal to Augustine here to get us to the beginning of the universe. The engines of Augustine's spaceship are off, and he has been moving through space by sheer inertia throughout all eternity. He never began his journey. So are you picturing this? As Augustine passes by the spectators, they register his velocity. Because the spectators are moving away from each other, they are flying apart, Augustine's velocity relative to the spectators will decrease as he passes by each observer. For example, suppose that Augustine passes the Earth at 100,000 kilometers per second and heads towards another galaxy 1 billion light years away. And suppose also that the galaxy is moving away from the Milky Way at 20,000 kilometers per second. When Augustine finally catches up with that galaxy, the other observers will see him moving at 80,000 kilometers per second. Now, do I know that this is the way that it would decrease, or do they know that? It doesn't matter. But you know that the speed is going to decrease, right, as they pass each observer. That's the whole point of this. This entails that Augustine's velocity gets smaller and smaller as he continues his journey. Therefore, if we were to take a time machine and follow Augustine's journey backwards into the past, his velocity would be getting larger and larger. This further entails that in the limit, his velocity should get arbitrarily close to the speed of light. According to Einstein, nothing can travel faster than the speed of light in this universe. Right? That's a law of general relativity. So
I can tell you how fast they're going, but that's
yeah. So while we are traveling into the past in our time machine, we encounter a phenomenon that runs contrary to our preconceived idea of a past eternal universe. That is, we notice that while the clocks of the spectators continue to record moments into the infinite past, we note that their clocks approach past infinity. That is to say, we note that their clocks approach past infinity. Augustine's clock is still finite. Now remember, he never began his journey. But his clock is finite, and then their clocks are reaching, you know, an infinite number. This is because a moving clock ticks slower than a stationary one. Therefore, the closer Augustine gets to the speed of light, the slower his clock runs. The spectators will perceive Augustine moving slower and slower until, as he reaches the speed of light, he comes to a halt. To be sure, Augustine will not notice anything unusual. For him, the moment he is traveling at the speed of light is like every other moment, which is presumably preceded by an infinity of moments. He has a clock that is finite, and he has a history that is infinite. This, of course, is a contradiction. One cannot possess a finite clock that records an infinite duration of time. And so a choice must be made. We conclude that Augustine's clock is not finite, but infinite, a conclusion that contradicts general relativity. Why does it contradict general relativity? Because to say that his clock is infinite is just to say that he can travel faster than the speed of light. Or we conclude that Augustine's actual history is finite. We cannot embrace the former. As Ross observes, today it can be said that no theory of physics has ever been tested so many different contexts and so rigorously as general relativity. And, he says, general relativity has withstood all the tests remarkably well that we've put against it. What holds for Augustine also holds for the spectators, for we must recall that he is moving relative to them. Thus, their history must be finite precisely because his is. Vilenkin draws out the implications of his theorem for the inflationary and oscillating models. He says this, "A remarkable thing about this theorem is its sweeping generality. We made no assumptions about the material content of the universe. We did not even assume that gravity as described is true as described by Einstein's equations." I'm going to say that again. We did not even assume that gravity is described by Einstein's equations. So if Einstein's gravity requires some modification, our conclusion will still hold. The only assumption that we made was that the expansion rate of the universe never gets below some non-zero value, no matter how small. And this assumption should certainly be satisfied in the inflating false vacuum. And the conclusion is that past eternal inflation without a beginning is impossible. Are y'all following this?
No past without a beginning.
Right. No past without a beginning, in a nutshell. But I want y'all to point out, you just need to understand that their assumptions are very broad. So they're not bringing a whole lot of baggage into this thought experiment. It's just some common sense intuitions that you bring into this, and these are the results. What about a cyclical universe? It has alternating periods of expansion and contraction. Can this help the universe to escape from the clutches of the theorem? The answer turns out to be no. An essential feature of the cyclic scenario, which allows us to avoid the heat death problem, is that the volume of the universe increases in every cycle. So on average, the universe is expanding. In my paper with Bord and Guth, we showed that as a result of this expansion, the space traveler's velocity increases on average as we go back in time and still approaches the speed of light in the limit. Hence, the same conclusions apply. After surveying all the major alternatives to the absolute beginning of the cosmos, Craig observes, of course, in view of the metaphysical issues raised by the prospect of a beginning, we may be confident that the quest to avert such a beginning will continue unabated. Such efforts are to be encouraged, and we have no reason to think that such attempts at falsification will result in anything other than further corroboration of the prediction of a beginning. In the meantime, the beginning cannot be wished away. Yes.
So even just kind of going back up to talking about the cyclic universe, where they're talking about the volume increasing every cycle, then wouldn't that mean that there was a point in that cycle where there was like no volume?
Right.
Because eventually, you know, like
if you go back in time, it still gets smaller and smaller and smaller.
Right. So you're dealing with something that is fundamentally finite.
Yes.
And it's something that is continually changing, which is further kind of reinforcing its contingency.
Exactly. Here's another way to look at this. What they are doing in the theorem is they're giving physical evidence, assuming general relativity. They're giving physical evidence for our arguments about the infinite past, our philosophical arguments. In other words, they're given scientific confirmation, genuine scientific confirmation of these arguments that we've already gone through about how actual infinities can't exist and or you can't traverse the infinite through finite equations. That's a mathematical point that we made. Now we're making it as a physical, as a physics point. And their theoretical physics paper has shown that that poor Augustine has to have a starting point in his journey.
Right.
That is what the science shows.
The science basically can't outpace the conceptual philosophy on this point.
Right. You're going to have to just deny general relativity if you want to say that the universe is past eternal, which is not a smart thing to do. The abundance of helium in the universe. This is another argument for the beginning of the universe. So we've gone through six alternatives, and we've found all of them wanting so far. And along the way, we've looked at three lines of evidence. So now we're at evidence number four. And by evidence, I mean scientific evidence. The abundance of helium in the universe. Hydrogen, consisting of only one single electron revolving around a nucleus that is composed of a single proton, is the simplest element in the universe, and hence we should not be surprised to discover that it is the most abundant element in the cosmos. It composes roughly 75% of all the matter in the universe. Astronomers have calculated that during the first 3 minutes after the Big Bang, the conditions of the cosmos at that time would have favored the clumping of protons and neutrons together into groups of four in order to form the element helium, consisting of two electrons circling around a nucleus composed of two neutrons and two protons. It has been estimated that after 30 minutes, 25% of all the matter in the universe would have been converted into helium. After the Big Bang, as the universe began to cool down, conditions no longer favor the clumping of hydrogen atoms to form helium, and hence the production of helium in this manner ceased. However, astronomers have discovered that more helium has been produced from hydrogen by the nuclear reactions that occur within the interiors of stars. These stars, in turn, explode at the end of their lives, spraying the helium they have manufactured into space. This new helium is then added to the primordial helium that existed only 30 minutes after the Big Bang. Thus, the amount of helium in our universe is steadily increased. In order to test whether or not their estimate is correct, that is, whether or not the universe was composed of roughly 25% of helium 30 minutes after the Big Bang, astronomers have since measured the amount of helium contained in the cosmos' oldest stars, stars that were formed when the universe was young, which would mean that the helium in these stars is almost entirely primordial. The result of the helium measurements, on the oldest stars is that the abundance of primordial helium in the universe is approximately 25%, in very good agreement with the Big Bang prediction. This agreement is particularly significant because it indicates that we have an accurate knowledge of the conditions of the universe as far back as only a few minutes after the Big Bang. Because the Big Bang theory is able to make accurate predictions about what we are going to discover about our current era, like the background radiation or the earliest moments after the Big Bang, the amount of helium in our cosmos, we have yet another reason to believe it is true. Remember, what is the hallmark of a good scientific theory? Future predictions. And the Big Bang has made several very important predictions about how the universe looked or how it does look. So the evidence just keeps coming. Then the life story of stars. All the heavier elements of the universe, such as carbon, oxygen, and aluminum, as we have seen, are produced through the burning of nuclear fires within stars, which consume hydrogen and leave a residue of these heavier elements. Hydrogen, then, is the building block for all the elements in the cosmos. When a star uses up its reservoir of hydrogen, there's no way it can go back to its original state, and when the hydrogen in any star disappears, it is gone forever. Thus, as the universe grows older, the amount of hydrogen in the cosmos grows smaller, while, at the same time, the amount of the other elements grows more numerous. It is by observing the life of a star that one is driven to the conclusion that there was once a time when the universe was composed of nothing but hydrogen, for it is only through fresh hydrogen that a star can form. And since hydrogen can't be formed now, we're only left with one conclusion. All the hydrogen that existed at the beginning. It's been decreasing ever since. And that is also a prediction of the Big Bang Theory. And so as Jastrow states, this point in time must have marked the beginning of the universe. What point in time? The point in time in which there was nothing but hydrogen. So do y'all see how all of this evidence coalesces to give you a strong case for a beginning of the universe? Is that relatively clear? So we're gonna give a conclusion here. Broadly speaking, we have seen three lines of evidence for the absolute beginning of the universe. First, it is impossible for an actually infinite number of things to exist. And since a past eternal universe consists of an actually infinite number of moments, the past history of the universe must be actually finite. Second, it is impossible to add to an actual infinite through successive addition, and since the events of the universe are formed through successive addition, the number of past events that have occurred in our universe is actually finite. Third, there are at least five lines of empirical and or scientific evidence for beginning of the cosmos. Namely, Hubble's observation that the universe is expanding, Penzias and Wilson's discovery of the primordial fireball, the second law of thermodynamics, the Big Bang Theory's accurate prediction concerning the amount of helium in our universe, and then the life story of stars. Two more lines of evidence at the beginning of the cosmos should be noted. First, Einstein's theory of relativity, which is arguably the most successfully tested theory of modern physics, long ago predicted the discovery of the expanding universe. And second of all, the numerous attempts to do away with the universe's beginning, being mostly motivated by an anti-theistic and or anti-metaphysical bias, have little to no evidence in their favor and have actually done little more than increase our confidence in the hot Big Bang model. Indeed, as the atheist philosopher Quentin Smith suggests, he says, "I would endorse the idea that it is metaphysics, not physics, that partly motivates against all evidence the attraction to an infinitely old universe." That's quite a quotation. The fact of the matter is that the majority of astronomers living today agree with our premise that the universe had a beginning. Indeed, many have come to this conclusion virtually against their wills. For example, Einstein privately wrote, "This circumstance of an expanding universe irritates me. To admit such possibilities seems senseless." Arthur Eddington concurred, writing, "I have no axe to grind in this discussion, but the notion of a beginning is repugnant to me. I simply do not believe that the present order of things started off with a bang. The expanding universe is preposterous, incredible. It leaves me cold." The German chemist Walter Nernst wrote, "To deny the infinite duration of time would be to betray the very foundations of science." Alan Sandage of the Carnegie Observatories, who established the uniformity of the expansion of the cosmos out to nearly 10 billion light years, exclaimed, "It is such a strange conclusion. It cannot really be true." And Philip Morrison of MIT confessed, "I find it hard to accept the Big Bang Theory. I would like to reject it, but I have to face the facts." And yet, despite their reservations, all of these men, as Morrison insists, had to come to terms with the facts. Thus, Eddington elsewhere stated that he felt the very idea of an expanding universe and its implied beginning was so preposterous and incredible that I feel almost an indignation that anyone should believe in it, except myself. That's freaking hilarious to me. I feel an indignation that anyone would believe it, except me. I can believe it. Four well-known astronomers have concluded this. The universe began from a state of infinite density. Space and time were created in that event, and so was all the matter in the universe. It is not meaningful to ask what happened before the Big Bang. It is like asking what is north of the North Pole. Similarly, it is not sensible to ask where the Big Bang took place. The point universe was not an object isolated in space. It was the entire universe, and so the only answer can be that the Big Bang happened everywhere. Again, you cannot in your mind's eye imagine this happening. Your mind's eye will always put a little explosion out in empty space somewhere. But the universe began, and with it, space itself began. And since all of your images are spatio-temporal, you can't imagine this. You can conceive of it, but in your mind's eye, you can't really imagine it. It's not a void, because it's not, there's a void is itself a presupposes space. This is extremely important. We have to wrap our minds around the fact that we can't wrap our minds around it. The British physicist P.C.W. Davies remarks that the Big Bang proves an origin of the universe out of nothing. He says this, if we extrapolate this prediction to its extreme, we reach a point when all distances in the universe have shrunk to zero. An initial cosmological singularity therefore forms a past temporal extremity to the universe. We cannot continue physical reasoning or even the concept of space-time through such an extremity. For this reason, most cosmologists think that the initial singularity is the beginning of the universe. On this view, the Big Bang represents the creation event, the creation not only of all the matter and energy in the universe, but space-time itself. Barrow and Tipler concur. At this singularity, space and time came into existence. Literally nothing existed before the singularity. So if the universe originated at such a singularity, we would truly have a creation ex nihilo. Since the singularity occurs at a finite time in the past, there is a temptation to ask the question, what happened before the singularity? However, this question makes as much sense as the question, what happened before the universe began, assuming that it had existed forever? In both cases, the answer is that nothing happened before, because there is no before in either case. By the way, Tipler has since these words become a Christian. Right.
The Human Genome Project.
Sure.
Becoming believers.
Yeah, the science is leading them.
The other way around than the markers.
Exactly. So they're just, many of them are embracing the idea, at least of God's existence, if not the Christian worldview itself. In light of our evidence, along with the scientific consensus, we can hardly blame Vilenkin for insisting, and this is one of my favorite quotations in this regard. He says, "It is said that an argument is what convinces reasonable men, and a proof is what it takes to convince even an unreasonable man. With the proof now in place," these are his words, proof. "With the proof now in place, cosmologists can no longer hide behind the possibility of a past eternal universe. There is no escape. They have to face the problem of a cosmic beginning." And so we end this discussion by noting the words of Stephen Hawking, who, when speaking of the prediction of a past singularity, when all the laws of physics no longer apply to the universe, since none of them yet existed, he tells us that our growing knowledge of the expanding universe has led to the abandonment of attempts, mainly by the Russians, to argue that there was a previous contracting phase and a non-singular bounce into expansion, in other words, an oscillating universe. He says, instead, these are his words, instead, almost everyone now believes that the universe and time itself had a beginning at the Big Bang. Now that is my evidence for the second premise of the Kalam argument. So before I go forward, what are your thoughts on all of this? This is impressive.
What does he mean mainly by the Russians?
It was Russian cosmologists who were the last holdouts on the oscillating universe. This was mainly... Well, I don't know if it was necessarily for political reasons, but, you know, they...
Communism marginally leans on atheism.
They grew up in a secularist context, a communist context, and so it makes sense that they would be the ones that held out for a long time. So, how are we doing? Well, then, that leads us to go back to the first premise of the argument. The first premise of the argument, remember, we said we're going to hold off on that one until we establish the second premise. The first premise is that whatever begins to exist requires a cause for its coming into existence. Is there anyone who really questions that premise? It is difficult to find a person who sincerely does so. In fact, down through the ages, its most ardent defenders have been atheists. This is the atheistic premise. For example, the Russian philosopher Lucretius famously said that ex nihilo nihil fit, out of nothing, nothing comes. It is because of this causal principle that historically atheists have embraced a past eternal universe. I mean, think about it. I mean, one of the reasons why we did the workaround through Thomas Aquinas was because we knew that there were going to be people that held up a huge resistance to a universe with a beginning. And so why does Thomas develop his argument in the first place? Well, he does so because in his day he thought it was impossible to prove that the universe had a beginning. So he showed that God exists on the assumption the universe did not have a beginning. That's the classical atheistic view. The classical atheistic view is that the cosmos is all there ever is, was, or will be. But now we know different. We at least know that through the science, if not the philosophy. It is because of this causal principle that historically atheists have embraced a past eternal universe. I've just repeated myself. And so when atheists have been asked, how did the universe get here, or where did the universe come from, atheists have given an intriguing answer. Namely, the universe did not come from anywhere. It has always been here. Or in the words of Bertrand Russell, I should say that the universe is just there, and that's all. As long as there was no good reason to think the universe had a beginning, one might suppose that this kind of answer may very well be reasonable. But now, with the very strong evidence favoring a temporally finite universe, one must confront the question squarely. Why is there something rather than nothing? Why does the universe exist? One of the most fascinating phenomena of our day is that atheists, because they can no longer retreat behind the possibility of an eternal cosmos, have begun to doubt the causal principle in increasing numbers. This is what you're going to find on the internet. You throw this argument out at atheists, they're going to roll their eyes and say, oh, that's just a stupid argument. Well, why is it stupid? Because there's really good evidence for an eternal universe? No. Well, because the evidence that we have for a universe that began to exist is really bad? No. Because the causal principle isn't true. That's why it's a bad argument. Craig reports the following. He says, when I first wrote the Kalam cosmological argument, this is back in the 70s, I figured that few atheists would deny the first premise and assert that the universe sprang into existence uncaused out of nothing, since I believed they would thereby expose themselves as persons interested only in an academic refutation of the argument and not in really discovering the truth about the universe. To my surprise, however, many atheists have taken this route. For example, Quentin Smith, commenting that philosophers are too often adversely affected by Heidegger's dread of the nothing, concludes that the most reasonable belief is that we came from nothing, by nothing, and for nothing. A nice ending to a sort of Gettysburg address of atheism, perhaps. Think about that. There was absolutely nothing, and then poof, the universe began to exist. There was no God, no matter, no space, no time, not even the potential for the universe to be, because potentiality is a kind of something. There was nothing, and then poof, the universe popped into being, uncaused, out of nothing. Think about that for a second. That's what the atheists want you to believe. I don't have enough faith to be an atheist. That takes a lot of faith.
Yes.
And it's faith in what? It's faith in nothing. Now, I want to, before I even go a step further, I think when I'm reading these essays online, and I'm constantly reading up on these things, and most of it is not even worth responding to, but you'll get on YouTube and you'll find YouTube videos that say, the Kalam argument easily debunked. William Lane Craig gets trashed in this debate, and then you watch the debate and you see William Lane Craig winning the debate. There's a guy out there that keeps posting these videos of Craig, and he goes, Craig gets destroyed by another atheist. And you watch the debate, and Craig defeats the other atheist. It's really funny to watch. But what I think is going on here, and Craig has alluded to this and some others have, what I think some people interpret the causal law as is this. The causal law is a law of restraint. Nothingness is wanting to produce something, and the law is keeping it from producing something. That's kind of in their minds, the causal principle is a law of restraint. But nothingness is nothing. Nothing is not trying to do anything. There's nothing. The causal principle is just a metaphysical principle that you can't derive something from nothing without some cause. That's all it is. It's not some law of restraint that keeps what would otherwise happen from happening. Yeah.
Would this idea of, quote unquote, for the sake of argument, nothingness attempting to exist or create something go even against like the law of entropy, which is like
of course
is trying to devolve and become nothing?
Sure.
Trying to wind down?
Of course.
So if everything's trying to wind down, why on earth would it be like trying to why would all the things that don't exist be trying to wind themselves up?
Exactly.
That goes against what we've empirically observed.
Yes, that's a good point. It's like, oh, I got to come into existence, and they come into existence only to spend the rest of their time, however long it is, winding down.
I guess you could kind of call that the cosmic cat theory. As soon as it goes outside, it wants back into the house.
Right.
You
outside.
Yeah. So that's what we're faced with. Now, I say that there is a growing number of atheists who are denying the first premise, whatever begins to exist has to have a cause. So I find it necessary to offer reasons to support the premise that everybody else already knows. This is something everybody knows. In fact, there are at least three arguments we can give to support the universal application of the causal principle. And again, I would like to say this. I don't think this is a necessary feature of the argument. I don't think that you have to get engaged in this discussion with 99.9% of the people out there. I just give the episode of my son who said, well, Dad, why do you think God exists? And I'm like, well, let me tell you about a man named Stephen Hawking. Told him he was the smartest theoretical physicist around and all this. He's our modern Einstein. And then I gave the quote of Hawking where he says, almost everyone now believes that the universe and time itself had a beginning at the Big Bang. I gave that quote to Evan. And then I said, now, what that means is that every scientist now believes, or almost all of the scientists now believe, that the universe had an absolute beginning. And then I just said, well, have you ever noticed that things have to have causes if they're going to happen? Well, yeah. Well, if the universe had a beginning, then it has to have a cause, right? Well, yeah. And that is not complete. So this is a wonderful argument to give to your kids. Now, I also have to remind you, the Kalam argument is so persuasive, but it's not as strong as the Thomistic argument, precisely because tomorrow the scientists could discover that the universe has always been here or something. You know, in other words, scientific evidence is always open to revision in the future. But what does the rational person do? We've already had that discussion, right? So, but what does the rational person do? The rational person follows the evidence where it leads. And since today the evidence is leading us to affirm a beginning, we affirm a beginning. Maybe 50 years from now, we'll have to throw this argument out. Or
take what you know at the time.
Yeah, you take what you know at the time. Now, I will say that the philosophical arguments stand whether the science confirms it or not, but hypothetically, let's say that someone comes in and gives us a debunking of the philosophical arguments, and let's say that 10 years later, we have all this evidence coming in that the universe did not begin to exist. well, then the Kalama argument would no longer be a strong argument for God's existence. But as long as this evidence remains, and it does, and our prediction is that this will only increase, this is why Craig, if you remember what I just read of him, he said, we hope that they keep continuing to offer alternatives. Because our prediction is that those alternatives will be debunked. It's not enough for you to offer a possible model that avoids the beginning. It's you have to offer a plausible model that's more plausible than the Big Bang theory itself. Yeah.
So the argument about the universe's contingency is itself contingent?
Yes. Very, very good. So at least it is further confirmation of the Thomistic argument, if not the Kalam. Now, here's the first argument in favor of the causal principle. The causal principle is analytically true. This is what I submit to you here. Whatever begins to exist, by definition, is a contingent sort of thing. For that which is contingent is that which is changing, finite, and dependent upon another for its existence. Indeed, a contingent reality is one that can not exist. It is possible for it to go out of existence. And so, whatever begins to exist is obviously changing, for it once did not exist and now does exist. It is finite, for it is limited, at least spatially and temporally, and it is clearly a mixture of actuality and potentiality. For it once did not exist, for if it once did not exist, then it can cease existing now. When we come across a contingent reality, we are logically forced to ask, why does it exist rather than not? We cannot say that it is just there and that's all, for it need not be there. It need not exist. Nor can we coherently assert that it brought itself into existence, for that would be a example of self-creation, which is impossible. And I've gone over that a gazillion times. Why is a self-created thing impossible? Because a self-created thing is something that exists before it exists. And that is a logical contradiction. This leaves us with only one option. Namely, it began to exist, therefore it is an effect of a cause other than itself. Immanuel Kant says this. He says, if therefore a thing is assumed to be contingent, it is an analytic proposition to say that it has a cause. That's a direct quote from him. Okay? But there's another thing to think about. Let's say that and I need to clean this up a little bit. But let's say that the causal principle is not analytical. And there are actually two ways to use the word contingent. One way to use the word contingent is something that does not exist in all logically possible worlds. That's a conceptual version of contingency. The other way to use the word contingent is the sort of factual way that I just said. A contingent thing is finite, changing, and dependent. Now, if you speak about factual contingency, then it is analytically true that if you're contingent, you need a cause. If you're talking about logical contingencies, then maybe it's not analytically true that you need a cause. However, the law of causality at that point would be a precondition of thinking. As Kant argued, the human mind is born in this world with certain categories which serve as transcendentals or preconditions of reasoning. What would be an example of a transcendental? It'd be like the laws of logic. You have to use those to understand the world around you. So these are preconditions of your thinking. That's what helps you guide everything you think about in this world. We cannot understand our experience without the laws of logic. Indeed, it's not as though the laws of logic are derived from experience, for it is those very laws which allow us to interpret the experience in the first place. And the causal law serves a similar function. It is what the mind uses to understand our experiences that is not properly derived from such experience. In the words of Hackett, if I attempt, for example, to derive the category of causation from experience, I find that I've already used this very structure of thought to infer the presence of an object and thus make the possibility of existential experience intelligible. It was because of the indispensability of the causal principle that Kant, even though he could not affirm it as an analytical a priori, what is a priori? It is something that you know before experience. Went on to insist that the causal principle is a synthetic a priori. That is to say, even though the law might not be analytically true, we ought not see it as a synthetic truth derived from experience. Rather, it is a synthetic a priori transcendental. I'm going to have to define all these terms for you. Synthetic, because it may not be strictly contradictory to rejected. A priori, because it precedes experience. And transcendental, because one cannot interpret experience without it. We have already argued that the causal relation is analytic, not synthetic. Indeed, our quotation of Kant above implies that deep down he saw this. But in any case, we agree with Kant that this principle is a category of the mind. Now, the categories of the human mind are objective features of both the mind and extramental reality. Indeed, the human mind is not sealed off from the real world, but is a part of reality. And since the causal law is one of these mental categories, the causal relation must hold in the real world. Now, that gets kind of deep, right? So, talk to me. Where did you get off the train? It's 9 o'clock in the evening. Some people are watching Seinfeld, which is great philosophy, by the way.
It's a great analysis of the human condition.
Sure. So, where did you get off the train?
What is the distinction between analytic and synthetic?
Okay, very good. So first, let's talk about analytic propositions and synthetic propositions. I'll give you the examples and then unpack it. A bachelor is an unmarried man. That is an analytical truth. All I have to do is know what the word bachelor means to know that bachelors are unmarried. In fact, that's what bachelor means. So it's just analytically true that a bachelor is an unmarried man.
It's by definition.
So upon analysis of the terms involved, you just know it's true by definition. By analysis. Okay. All triangles have three angles, obviously. All triangles have three sides. Those are analytical truths. Right. So got what an analytical truth is? Alex Merrill is a bachelor.
But that's a conditional truth.
That is a synthetic proposition because there's nothing about Alex Merrill as such that demands that I interpret him as bachelor. And so how do I know a synthetic truth? I know a synthetic truth by experience. I have to get to know you and know that you're a bachelor. Right? So a synthetic truth is one that is not true by definition. It's just true, factually speaking.
True by experience.
It's true by experience. It is just a factual assertion. Okay? So that's the first leg in our little journey into this.
So an analytic proposition is one which is constantly true. Basically, it is what it is.
Right.
It's a statement of fact.
It, too, could be considered a statement of fact, but you and I can conceive of a day where the word bachelor might take on a new meaning.
Right.
Right.
But all
that would happen, and this is Shakespeare, right? A rose by any other, the name is still a rose. So we would obviously have maybe a different term that signified unmarried man.
Exactly. An unmarried man is an unmarried man, whatever you want to call him.
Right.
It's like he is still a male. So it's basically the truth remains the truth, but then there are some true statements which are...
They're just...
It's our buzzword, but it's contingent on certain circumstances and observations.
Exactly. And so your being a bachelor right now is just contingent on a whole host of factors that can very well change within the next year or two, right?
It's a social condition.
One can hover.
Say Alex is a man, and that's a statement of fact, but I can say he's a bachelor, and that's a social condition.
Sure. So that's, y'all get synthetic?
And one that can change, whereas, bachelors will always be unmarried men. That's just,
I don't know, now bachelor means you date 20 women at the same time.
Sure. I understand that people are trying to change terms, but these are good things to go off of. And these rules don't change because of linguistic convention and all that stuff. All right, so analytic statements and synthetic statements. Now we have two other terms to define. A priori and a posteriori. The meaning of the words a priori and a posteriori are kind of contained in those words. A priori means from the prior. And what does that mean? Well, it's prior to experience. So an a priori statement is a statement that you don't need to experience to know is true. For example, all bachelors are unmarried men is something you can learn before you experience its truth. Now, I understand that human beings really don't learn apart from experience. I get that. But the point is that you don't need to have any number of experiences to know the truth of that statement. That's just the point of it. And a good example of an a priori argument would be the ontological argument. God is the greatest conceivable being, and so you'll notice that through a conceptual analysis of the term God, we conclude that God exists. Whether that argument is sound is a different issue, but you get the fact that it's a priori in character. And so all of the arguments that we looked at in chapter 2 had an a priori thrust to them. You can simply know by an analysis of these terms the truth of the statement. So far, so good? That's a priori. Yes.
That was kind of been like a bit of a sticking point with me when it comes to a priori. You kind of mentioned it right there. Is there truly any way to divorce our conceptualizations from our experience? Don't all of our conceptualizations require some experience as a reference point?
Ultimately, no. And I think that's just how we're built.
Right.
I mean, we're built to learn through experience. And this is why there are empiricists out there that would really roll their eyes at something like the ontological argument. It's too abstract, it's too abstruse, it's, you know, so all those things. We only know from our experiences.
Right.
And now the Kalam argument is going to meet that person very well because it's a scientific-based, at least you construct it
right
as a scientific-based argument.
Yeah. Like I don't have a problem with the ontological argument. I think it's still a very good argument.
It's right,
a good one to have in repertoire. But it's just more kind of like, I feel like when it comes to talking about a priori, you're kind of like talking about degrees of conceptualization versus experience.
I have not read enough in epistemology to find that person for you,
right,
but you can, I'm sure, find many theorists of knowledge who would have an empirical bent about them, and they would say, at the best you have degrees of conceptualization whereby I can know certain things as analytically true, but I never know anything apart from experience. At best, I have experiences that confirm them or ideas that my experience point to or something like that. So.
Because from the moment we come into existence, we are experiencing existence.
Sure.
So there's no way for us to really separate.
We can't avoid our history and all that stuff wholly when we look at these things.
But like you said, there's points and degrees at which we can think of things haven't necessarily personally observed yet, based on things that we have observed. And we're kind of like projecting
exactly
from a little experience we have into a really big idea.
I would follow that. Thomas is more or less a hypothetical guy.
Right.
I'm simply saying that if we were in a cave and if we could think in a cave, we could know that God exists with absolute certainty. But the argument is sound whether that hypothetical scenario is true or not. And it just illustrates the point that the idea of God is analytically true. Just when you know what the term God means, you just know that God exists. All right, now, we're in the middle of the second leg here. So we've looked at analytic and synthetic, and we're in the middle of talking about a priori. So we look at a posteriori. Well, that means from the posterior. And so posterior to experience. Yeah.
Now you're talking language.
Right. Gotcha. Yeah. Let's see. So posterior to experience. In light of an experience, I come to these conclusions. So analytically and in an a priori way, I know that bachelors are unmarried men. Through experience, in a synthetic way, I know that Alex Merrill is a bachelor. So far, so good? So what you have is this neat little division between the analytic a priori and the synthetic a posteriori. So far, so good? Kant, Immanuel Kant, was awakened from his dogmatic slumbers by David Hume and came to the realization that he needs to come up with yet a third category. And what is that? The third category would be the synthetic a priori. And what is a synthetic a priori? It is a statement that is not necessarily certain in the sense that you're committing a contradiction by denying it. and yet is still a necessary precondition to understand our world around us. Okay? So, if I say that, and again, we don't want to get into the linguistics of it, right? But if I say all bachelors are unmarried men, and you say to me, no, I met a bachelor the other day, and he's a married guy, I would say, contradiction. You've committed a contradiction. And so I know with certainty that you're wrong because you're just denying the very definition. I would just say that guy you met wasn't really a bachelor. Right? So far, so good. A synthetic statement that is known a priori would be something like the causal law. So what Kant is saying is that even though you're not committing a contradiction in saying universe pops into being uncaused out of nothing, you're still contradicting something that is a precondition for our knowledge of the world. Why are you, in other words, the causal principle, and by the way, this is not really Kant so much as those of us who are using him, but the causal principle is something that I have to hold on to understand the world around me. If I give up the causal principle, I can't do science. I can't do anything. It's a precondition of thinking, right? It's a category of the mind. So I'm not committing a contradiction in denying it, but I am still beholden to the law because without the law, I can't understand the world around me. And that's what makes it transcendental. It's transcendental because a transcendental is just a category of the mind that serves as a precondition of thinking. And what are Kant's categories? They are synthetic a priori's. How are we doing? I've unpacked all that for you. I think we got it.
So he's kind of doing he's doing that mix and match where he is coming. He's using quote unquote purely conceptual arguments that or propositions that happen before experience that are.
Well, let me stop you there and throw in the wrinkle. Now, if you really want to understand this, Nathan and I, when we went through the worldviews last year, I stopped and gave a full thing on Kant. And I believe it's on our agnosticism. So it's early on in the series where we just unpacked Immanuel Kant and talked about him. So I'm just going to give you the skinny right here. Immanuel Kant limited the use, and this is where we get in trouble with the Kalam argument. Okay, so this is the give and take in using Kant. Kant is good because Kant establishes the causal law as a necessary precondition of thinking. Right? So far, so good. Where it's bad is that Kant is the one who said that none of the categories of human reason can be applied to the world, the soul, and God, or God and the soul and the world as a whole. Human categories of reasoning cannot know God. Human categories of reasoning cannot know whether there is a soul, and human categories of reasoning cannot know anything about the world as a whole. Why? Because when we apply these categories to things like the world, we commit contradictions. And therefore, we can only use the categories to understand reality as it appears to us, not reality as it really is. Now, you might be wondering, therefore, what that last sentence was all about, and that's what that last sentence was all about. What did I say? The categories of the human mind are objective features of both the mind and extramental reality. Indeed, the human mind is not sealed off from the real world, but is a part of that reality. And since the causal law is one of these mental categories, and then I'm quoting Craig, the causal relation must hold in the real world. Why is Craig and by extension me, why are we insisting upon that? Because we know that Kant is a potential danger to us. And what we're trying to argue is that Immanuel Kant had the right projection. He was going in the right direction, but he flubbed up when he refused to apply the causal law to the real world or the world as a whole.
So basically, you know, it's like he's saying it's all within your mind, but the mind is part of reality, so you can't really divorce your mind from reality.
Exactly. And so that's our way of that's an argument for rejecting all the conclusions Kant makes about the causal law. Now, some of you might say, well, I want to know more about this. This is fascinating. Earlier lecture. I will say this. This is the heart of the debate on the creation of the universe. This is where the action is now in these debates between atheists and theists. And so, unfortunately, you got to get a little abstract in this if you want to master this material. And also, Immanuel Kant is the heart of liberal theology. Why? Because the categories of human reason cannot apply to God. And therefore, God is a purely emotional thing. So facts are facts, and faith is faith, and never the twain shall meet. So what Kant did philosophically, Schleiermacher and others just took and put in theological categories. So Kant had phenomena, the way the world appears to me, versus noumena, the way the world actually is. The liberal theologian has facts, things that are, faith, how I feel about them. Is Jesus really, factually, the Son of God? No. Do I believe he is? Yes. Is that coherent? Yes, because the laws of the categories of the mind can apply to God. So you can't know God. You can only feel at best what you think might be God. You have pointers to a transcendence that you can't know, and therefore you delineate that experience in propositions that try to help you understand, but those propositions in no way correspond to the transcendence you're seeking. That's liberal theology in a nutshell.
Okay, so this is like Karl Barth and like Christian existentialism.
Oh, of course. Karl Barth is a reaction to Schleiermacher, who in turn is building on Kant. And where Schleiermacher went totally immanent, God is this immanent presence. Schleiermacher is a pantheist, right? Barth is, he goes transcendence, whereas Schleiermacher goes immanence. But it's all the same kind of Kantian gobbledygook that just destroys any attempt to know God. And since we are, since I've been going, I know this is kind of deep for y'all. I'll quote the words of Paul to you to give you some theological relief. Paul says in 2 Corinthians 10:5, we destroy all arguments and pretensions that set themselves up against the knowledge of God. So I'm taking that verse and I'm applying that in my exposition right here. I'm trying to defend the causal principle as something that is really true of the real world and describe what really is going on. Why? Because one of the ways we know God is through the causal principle. And that's why the naturalist of our day is trying to take that away from us, so that we can't know God. And so that's why we defend the causal principle. Does that help? I'm going to move forward. Here's a better argument, and this is the one that I would give on the street. So the first two, you know, here's the one we can give on the street. The causal principle, this is the third argument for the causal principle. The causal principle is an empirical generalization which has never yielded an exception. Indeed, while we cannot derive the principle from sense experience, we can use it to understand our experience. And as we all know, the causal law has been confirmed in our experience throughout all of human history. As Craig writes, the causal proposition could be defended as an empirical generalization based on the widest sampling of experience. The empirical evidence in support of the proposition is absolutely overwhelming, so much so that human empiricists could demand no stronger evidence in support of any synthetic statement. See, you know the categories, right? You know what synthetic statements are, so you can interpret that sentence quite well. To reject the causal proposition is therefore completely arbitrary. Although this argument from empirical facts is not apt to impress philosophers, it is nevertheless undoubtedly true that the reason we and they accept the principle in our everyday lives is precisely for this very reason, because it is repeatedly confirmed in our experience, constantly verified, and never falsified. The causal proposition may be taken as an empirical generalization enjoying the strongest support experience affords. And this is why I looked at my son with a clear conscience and said, have you ever seen anything happen that it didn't have a cause behind it. No, Daddy, I've never seen that. Well, if the universe began to exist, then it has to have a cause. J.O. Mackey, an atheist, says this: we can certainly conceive of an uncaused beginning to be of an object. And yet he concedes that the causal principle has some plausibility and that it is constantly confirmed in our experience and also used reasonably in interpreting our experience. Hume himself, David Hume himself, claimed this. He says, "But allow me to tell you that I never asserted so absurd a proposition as that anything might arise without a cause. I only maintained that our certainty of the falsehood of that proposition proceeded neither from intuition nor demonstration, but from another source." Let me unpack that. Hume says this in a letter, and what he's getting at here is that he doesn't think that the causal proposition can be known with certainty. Well, where do we get our certainty of the causal principle? Custom. We grow up in an environment, and our environment teaches us this, from our personal experiences to what people tell us and so forth. That's where we get the certainty of the principle. Having said all that, even with that qualification, I use this David Hume quote a lot, and a lot of people like to use it because it's very powerful, because it is David Hume that made us doubt the causal principle. Well, he's the one that also said, "I never asserted so absurd a thing that something could happen without a cause." Well, why would he be so certain that it's absurd? Because I think deep down he knows the things just can't pop into being uncaused out of nothing. All right, how we doing? We're going to keep moving. Objections to the causal premise. Here are some objections to it. We have belabored what we think is an obvious point. Whatever begins to exist needs a cause. Who denies the point? Despite his endorsement of the causal principle, which we just read, David Hume did offer several considerations which have, in the minds of some, brought the law of causality into doubt. According to David Hume, the causal principle is not a truth of reason. He writes, "As all distinct ideas are separable from each other, and as the ideas of cause and effect are evidently distinct, 'twill be easy for us to conceive of any object to be non-existent this moment, and existent the next, without conjoining to it the distinct idea of a cause or productive principle. The separation, therefore, of the idea of a cause from that of a beginning of existence is plainly possible for the imagination, and consequently, the actual separation of these objects is so far possible that it implies no contradiction nor absurdity, and is therefore incapable of being refuted by any reasoning from mere ideas, without which 'tis impossible to demonstrate the necessity of a cause." So what is he saying here? Our experience concludes that things don't happen without causes. But if you want to demonstrate to me with certainty that something cannot begin to exist without a cause, you will fail. Why? Because I'm not committing a contradiction in asserting that something began to exist without a cause. I'm not committing a contradiction. I might be saying something false, but I'm not committing a contradiction. I'm not saying, "I see a square circle over there." I'm just saying, well, all I'm saying is this: no universe. And I'm not inferring a cause in the middle of that. So what? What contradiction have I committed? Yeah.
Basically just saying that something can exist without a beginning isn't inherently illogical, it's just empirically untrue.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, just like he said in that earlier quotation, I get this truth from custom. I don't get it from reason. See?
You gotta ask him for an example of something that begins without a cause.
He doesn't have to do that for you, because he's going to say, "I will grant I can't give that to you," right? What I will grant, what I'm trying to argue, is that this is not something I know with certainty. And see, here's what the atheist is going to try to say. They're going to say the calm argument is a bad argument, because whatever begins to exist without a cause is just, at best, an empirical generalization. But that doesn't mean you know that that's true. Something could pop into being without a cause. So it could happen. And as long as it could happen, then I'm reasonable in thinking that the universe began to exist and it didn't have a cause.
You just don't have any kind of evidence or precedent for it. It's just a conceptual possibility.
Yeah, it's a conceptual possibility. And since we're talking about this is a philosophical argument in the first place, and whatever begins to exist needs a cause is a philosophical principle that is not known with certainty, I can just imagine universes popping into being on cause out of nothing. Here it is. No universe. Boom. Universe. See? And I didn't put cause in there.
So we're back around to Hawking's circle, where you can basically come up with any theory so long as it's internally coherent and logically valid.
Right.
It doesn't actually have to match up with reality.
Yeah. Now, Hume would be the first to say that this point isn't proving that there is no cause of the universe. He's just saying that this is not a good argument for God's existence because we haven't proven that there is a cause. In order to prove that there is a cause, you have to know with certainty that anything that begins to exist has to have a cause. And you haven't shown that. You're just appealing to an empirical generalization that people just experience. But that doesn't mean that it has always happened that way. In a minute, we're going to look at the following objection. Just because it happens in it for everything in the universe doesn't matter mean that it has to happen to the universe as a whole. Well, I hear Immanuel Kant there. See? See how this... So this is what we're dealing with. So I'm going to skip the... I think I've exposited what he means by this quotation. So I'm going to skip what I comment on here and go to the response. And I say this, first, even if Hume's insight is sound and the causal law is not an analytical truth, I already argue that it is, right? But even if he's right and it's not an analytical truth, we would still not be in a position to say that something can begin to exist without a cause. This is what Elizabeth Anscombe has written. She says this. This is what Elizabeth Anscombe writes. She says, the trouble about Hume's argument is that it is very unconvincing. By the way, we have some time for this. Have you ever heard the story of C.S. Lewis losing an argument to a very well-informed philosopher? You don't know that story?
I don't.
In the 50s, he debated a philosopher. He had an argument for God's existence that was akin to the transcendental argument. And he presented that, and he debated a philosopher. And the word on the street is that she won. Well, that she is Elizabeth Anscombe, okay? Catholic philosopher. She's a theist, but she just didn't think Lewis's argument was that great. But so she's a fantastic mind, and here's what she says. She says, the trouble about Hume's argument is that it is very unconvincing. For if I say I can imagine a rabbit coming into being without a parent rabbit, well and good. I imagine a rabbit coming into being, and our observation that there is no parent rabbit about... And remember what I was doing just a minute ago? No universe. Universe. You can close your mind and just have universe pop into being, right? But what am I to imagine if I imagine a rabbit coming into being without a cause? Well, I just imagine a rabbit coming into being. That this is the imagination of a rabbit coming into being without a cause is nothing but, as it were, the title of a picture. Indeed, I can form an image and give my picture that title. But from my being about or able to do that, nothing whatever follows about what is possible to suppose without contradiction or absurdity is holding in reality. So you see what she's saying? Are you really imagining the rabbit coming into being without a cause? No, you're just arbitrarily imagining something and giving it a title. Rabbit coming into being without a cause. But that's not really an imagination of a rabbit coming into being. By the way, what is causing that image to pop into being? Your mind.
Because you've seen a rabbit somewhere before.
Right. And since it's your... But even the rabbit that you're imagining coming into existence is not coming into existence without a cause. Your mind is producing the image.
Right.
So you're not imagining a rabbit coming into existence without a cause. It'd be like me putting up a painting of a rabbit and I say... Painting with no painter.
But you've produced the image for us. You may not.
Painter did produce the image for you.
Yeah.
But I'm just giving it. Now, have I committed a contradiction when I put up a picture of a rabbit in front of you, a painting of a rabbit, and I say, painting without a painter. Have I committed a contradiction? No, but am I really imagining a painter? A painting without a painter? Am I really imagining that? No, I'm just giving the title of a picture. Has Hume really succeeded in convincing us that we can truly imagine? It's a word game. Very good. I mean, he's just playing a word game with us, which, you know, games can be played, but that's not really helpful in this whole discussion as to whether something can be and to be without a cause. And here's what Craig says. He says, all Hume has really shown is that the principle, everything that begins to exist has a cause of its existence, is not analytic, and that its denial, therefore, does not involve a contradiction or a logical absurdity. But just because we can imagine something's beginning to exist without a cause, it does not mean that this could ever occur in reality. There are other absurdities than logical ones. Think about that. There are other absurdities out there than logical ones. Here's an absurdity, and I'm not going to commit a logical contradiction at all when I'm about to tell you this, okay? Here's an absurdity. We have only existed for 5 minutes. Now, prove me wrong. You can't. Oh, but I have memories of growing up and living for someone. Maybe God created you 5 minutes ago and put all those memories in your head.
My 5 o'clock shadow is about 4 hours old.
Right.
He gave you the appearance
of the 5 o'clock shadow. And when you go home, you'll see pictures of a family that was only created, 5 minutes ago. And the dinner that Alex and I had, we didn't have that dinner. God implanted that memory in our heads.
Okay, Mr.
or young earth creationists, actually. Now, what I'm giving you is a perfectly coherent series of assertions. Who here thinks that I'm not being absurd? I think that what I just said is totally stupid and absurd. I don't care if it's logically coherent. And therefore, just because you show me, even if you did show me, and I don't even think you've shown me that, but even if you did show me that the law of causality is not analytically true, or that I'm not committing a contradiction and denying it, you've not demonstrated to me that you're not being absurd when you say that the universe popped into being uncaused out of nothing. And that's why Craig says, for the universe to spring into being uncaused out of nothing seems intuitively to be really, if not logically, absurd. And so even if Hume's correct, that is, even if one can coherently conceive of something beginning to exist without a cause, he has not established the real possibility of a non-cause beginning to be of something. But we have also pointed out that Hume is not correct. Indeed, it is both logically and intuitively absurd to suppose that anything can pop into being and cause out of nothing. For the causal principle is not only a precondition of thought, it is analytically true. Rejoinder. Some critics of our premise insist that the causal principle is only true of everything in the universe, but it's not true of the universe as a whole. This is what you're going to get on the internet over and over and over again. Therefore, those of us who apply the causal principle to the entire universe have done so without warrant. We have no good reason to move from the everything in the universe that begins to exist needs a cause to the universe as a whole begin to exist, therefore it needs a cause. You can't, those two are distinct statements. Everything in the universe that begins to exist needs a cause is not the same thing as the universe as a whole began to exist, therefore it needs a cause.
I'll go back to the painter.
Right.
Someone had to create that canvas.
Exactly. And just because you give it a title doesn't mean that your title is not absurd. So here's my second response. This objection, this idea that you can't apply the causal principle to the universe as a whole, this objection presupposes that the causal principle is merely an empirical generalization and thus can admit of exceptions. But this objection is unconvincing for two basic reasons. First, we refuse to grant the underlying presupposition of the objection, for the causal principle is no mere generalization. It is, one, analytically true. It is, two, a precondition of thought. And three, it is an empirical generalization which has never yielded an exception. Second, even if we did grant the underlying presupposition standing behind the objection, we are still left wondering how it overcomes our premise. Indeed, no one has ever offered a valid exception to the causal law. Therefore, the burden is clearly placed upon those who wish to arbitrarily jettison the principle when it yields a conclusion they are not comfortable with. In other words, rather than complain that we've applied the causal principle to the whole universe, the empiricist should consider the possibility that the constant verification of the principle has received, the constant verification the principle has received throughout history is itself a reason to think that if the whole cosmos came into existence, then we have good reason to think it was caused. During moments of brutal honesty, atheists will admit the absurdity of thinking that anything can just pop into being uncaused out of nothing. To quote Mackey, "I myself find it hard to accept the notion of self-creation from nothing, even given unrestricted chance. How can this be given if there really is nothing?" Craig follows up the quotation of Mackey with the following insight. He says, "Think about it. On the atheistic view, there wasn't even the potentiality for the universe's existence prior to the Big Bang, since nothing is prior to the Big Bang. But then, how could the universe become actual if there wasn't even the potentiality of its existence? It makes more sense to say that the potentiality of the universe lay in the power of God to create it." Second rejoinder. See, they're going to keep hitting us, right? We have to hit back. The critic of our argument will not stop here, for he might feel that there is something wrong with seeing causality as a precondition of thought. One such thinker is the agnostic philosopher Paul Draper. After criticizing our two philosophical arguments for the beginning of the universe, which are very similar to, if not exactly the same as, the criticisms we have already discussed, Draper, in a footnote, says that such Kantian maneuvering does not seem very promising in this context, for in order to reconcile it with the realism presupposed by the Kalam argument, one would need to claim that the causal principle must, as a necessary precondition of thought, hold without exception in the noumenal world. But this is precisely what Hackett and Craig have argued. This is my response to him. They've argued that. They've actually backed up the use of Kant in the way they're using him. The causal law holds in the noumenal world. And what I do in the footnote there is I just give you an elaboration on what the noumenal world is. It's the world as it really is. It's the real world. What's wrong with the assumption? If Draper answers that such a Kantian maneuver forces us to accept everything Kant had to say about the causal law, including the notion that causality applies to phenomena, not noumena, we simply reject this contention. It seems far more obvious to us that the causal relation holds universally than that it must be limited to mere phenomena. To counter our contention, Draper will have to give us more than assertions. And I'm going to let this be our last page, and then we're going to end our discussion.
It's a very prodigious footnote.
Yeah. But on page 330, this is our last page, page 330. Draper does not want to stop here, so we're at our third rejoinder, okay? Draper will not want to stop there. In fact, his major criticism of the Kalam argument is that it equivocates on the phrase "begins to exist." In the first premise of the argument, "begins to exist" is to be interpreted as "begins to exist within time," since experience only supports the notion that events have causes within the space-time universe. But in the second premise, the phrase "the universe began to exist" is to be interpreted as "the universe began to exist with time," since the evidence, as we have seen, indicates that time itself began to exist at the Big Bang. And since Craig equivocates in his use of "begins to exist," his argument is invalid or unsound. So again, what is the argument here? You're equivocating. You're using the term "begins to exist" in a different way throughout the argument. And that is a logical fallacy, and therefore you can't do that. This is the fallacy of equivocation. And my response to him is this. Draper is simply mistaken here for a univocal sense that is using the term in the same voice throughout. The univocal sense of "begins to exist" is perfectly available. To quote Craig, "X begins to exist" is by definition as follows. X exists at T, and there is no time prior to T at which X exists. That is to say, anything begins to exist just in case it exists at a certain time, and there's no time prior at which it exists. Hence, the universe began to exist means that it existed at the first moment of time, and there was no time prior to the first moment of time at which the universe existed. The Klom argument does not commit the fallacy of equivocation. I'm going to stop there. How are y'all doing?
Well, we're reading.
So, what's really going on here is, this is tennis, right? And you say, okay, the universe began to exist. Well, see, this is where the argument gets interesting, because how are you going to avoid the existence of God at this point? Your only hope is to render the causal principle somehow deniable. And so this is how they're doing it. Well, it's not known with certainty. So, well, you're equivocating on the word begins to exist, or the phrase begins to exist. No. Well, it's only applicable, the causal law, in the
universe. Really.
Oh, sure. And in the next argument, we actually see Draper committing the fallacy of equivocation. So this is sort of the tennis match that's going on. And when you're using this out there, you're not going to run into this. But this is what's helping you be prepared for it. So I hope that this has been helpful, and we can talk about the next time we meet.